Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yes, you need profits and brand awareness and loyal customers. A good sense of ethics is helpful too. But really, you're running a business, you need one thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday today, the 6th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. One word, gang. We begin today with one word. Four letters. Sometimes makes people uncomfortable, I grant you, but there is nothing to be squeamish about. C-A-S-H, gang. Cash. You want to run a business, you got to have it. And that is why, as things started to go south back in mid-March, a lot of companies figured they would be better able to ride out the storm that was coming by borrowing. A lot. Low interest rates and pressing demand drove corporate borrowing way up. But there are some new numbers out today from the financial data research firm Refinitiv that show corporate borrowing is back down to early March levels. That is to say, same as the before times. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on what might be going on here.
When companies were piling on debt back in March, April, and May, the economic picture was far from clear, says Stephen Davidoff Solomon at UC Berkeley.
But I think companies have a better idea of what's going on now.
Solomon says some companies have an optimistic outlook. They're looking at rising jobs numbers, increasing business activity, growth in the service sector, at least for now. So instead of borrowing more,
companies are probably saying, look, we have enough right now. Let's see where things go, and we'll take it from there.
Then there are companies that are feeling pessimistic. Colin Martin is a fixed income strategist at the Schwab Center for Financial Research. He says borrowing won't help some companies make it through the pandemic.
A lot of energy companies, we look at retail companies, brick and mortar stores that were already kind of deteriorating before this happened. Clearly, that outlook's pretty negative right now.
Martin says companies in those riskier sectors might be worried about defaulting on their existing debt.
We've actually seen the number of corporate defaults pick up. It's actually been rising at the fastest pace since 2009.
Then there are the cautious companies, borrowing less because they're counting on an economic recovery later this year. Jim Vogel is interest rate strategist at FHN Financial.
So what we'll have to watch for is whether people that thought we would get back to normal in the third quarter all of a sudden decide that that was a premature forecast.
And if the economy doesn't improve, Vogel says,
we'll see another round of borrowing as people have a better handle on what their own financial situation is.
Vogel says we'll get a better sense of how much corporations are willing to borrow as they report their earnings later this month. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Speaking of borrowing, the Small Business Administration published a much-awaited database today listing 660,000 recipients of Paycheck Protection Program loans, loans above $150,000, I should say, just to be clear. Lots and lots of interesting stuff in there as to who got them. Media companies, political organizations, big firms, small firms, nonprofits, and very much for-profits. I will just pause here to note that there is still, should your company be in need, more than $100 billion in that pot of money waiting to help you out. Lots of oil and gas news on this Monday. First of all, the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. Remember that? The Native American and environmental protests along its route a couple of years ago. Anyway, it has been shut down by a federal judge, ordered drained of oil, by the way, at least until the company that owns it does some environmental homework. Also, and item two, a multi-billion dollar natural gas pipeline that was going to cross the Appalachian Trail has been called off. Natural gas is, yes, a fossil fuel, cleaner, though, than coal. But as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, the decision to cancel the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the one crossing the Appalachian Trail, it does raise some bigger questions about the long-term future of natural gas in this economy.
For years, environmental opponents have been going to court, challenging the now-canceled Atlantic Coast Pipeline and other natural gas projects. Now, analyst Ryan Wabrock at the bond rating firm Moody's says opposition makes gas pipelines too iffy.
Their efforts to hang up projects like the Atlantic Coast Pipeline in the courts just makes the execution risk too high, the investment horizon too uncertain.
It's not just environmental groups. Christy Tizak at the research firm Clearview Energy Partners points out that many states plan to be zero carbon by 2050.
From a market perspective, we are seeing a shift away from natural gas in the electricity sector that's being pushed by state regulators and state legislatures.
Which raises a bigger question about natural gas long term. A decade ago, when the method of energy extraction known as fracking produced plentiful supplies, gas was often called the bridge fuel to transition America from coal to wind and solar. Noah Sachs teaches law at the University of Richmond.
If natural gas was ever a bridge fuel, I think we're coming to the end of the bridge. And utilities are saying, we don't think we need these pipelines.
To be sure, some investors are still betting on gas's future. Berkshire Hathaway yesterday paid $4 billion for existing gas pipelines and infrastructure from Dominion Energy. But future pipelines are the big question, to legal analyst Brandon Barnes at Bloomberg Intelligence.
Probably we'll see this through the end of 2020 at least, that there's nothing big that's going to be built. There just can't be.
He says the main challenge for natural gas pipelines, successful opposition in the courts, increasingly stands in the way of oil pipeline projects too. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
U.S. benchmark crude oil today, pretty steady, right around $40 a barrel. That is honestly pretty low if you make your living drilling for this stuff. In equities today, to start the first full week of the second half of a year we are all going to remember for a long, long time, well, it's going to be the happy music when we do the numbers. Here's the personal finance with much bigger picture economic impact ramifications story of the day for this Monday. Homeowners in this economy now have a record amount of what is known as tappable home equity, how much they can borrow against and still keep a 20% cushion. $6.5 trillion is the number for the first quarter of the year. That's from the mortgage data firm Black Knight. And if you're thinking right now that the first quarter ended in March just as the pandemic was really shutting down businesses, you ought to know that home values overall have only been going up since then. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, that could leave some in better shape to ride out this crisis than others.
Years of rising home values have fueled record levels of equity. And Black Knight economist Andy Walden says that's likely to continue as buyers compete for a limited supply of houses.
They're seeing these record low interest rates and they're out there shopping for homes and kind of sustaining those home prices out there in the market.
Homeowners, perhaps spooked by the last housing downturn, have also been reluctant to draw down their equity through cash-out refinancing or home equity loans, and lenders are more reluctant to let them.
And even those homeowners that are out there tapping into equity are leaving more meat on their bone and not fully tapping themselves out like we saw back in 2005, 6, 7, 8.
That housing wealth leaves homeowners in better shape to withstand the current crisis. Susan Wachter teaches real estate finance at the Wharton School. She says all that equity made it possible for Congress to let borrowers with federally backed mortgages defer payments for up to a year.
A majority of Americans are homeowners, and for them, they're not going to lose their home.
And if they have to, they can skip their mortgage payment to cover other necessities. The 35% of households that rent don't have that luxury. More renters are losing their housing as restrictions on evictions lift around the country.
So it's an extraordinary story of haves and have-nots, where the system is set up to support homeowners, but it doesn't protect renters.
Bill Emmons is lead economist at the Center for Household Financial Stability at the St. Louis Fed. He says homeowners generally have more stability.
People who are homeowners tend to have stronger financial positions, tend to be older, tend to have more education, higher income, higher wealth.
They also tend to be white. Black and Latino people are much less likely to own their homes, and their houses tend to appreciate more slowly. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One of the challenges of this quarantine life for a whole lot of people, I'd bet, yours truly included, has been quieting the mind, turning away from the day-to-day, finding other ways to occupy yourself. Art is a real good way to do that. Even if the museums are closed, there's painting and drawing, photography, also movies and music and television. The contributions that artists make to this economy are real, and in a pandemic, they come in different forms. Here is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Atiyah Jones, and I am a visual and multimedia artist living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. At the start of the pandemic, I really wasn't comfortable with the idea, especially of the men in my family, as Black men, going out into public spaces wearing bandanas on their face. And so I became a mask maker. You know, my friends call them luxury masks, in the interest of helping my family. And that quickly snowballed into a more public effort. And it quickly turned into something bigger for me. But it also felt really strange to be able to sustain my livelihood on the effects of a pandemic. Just as I was, you know, gaining stride in mask making and really kind of nailing down that schedule, the first week of June happened, and George Floyd's murder happened and Breonna Taylor's murder happened. And so I really started to look at what I could do from the couch. And I asked my Instagram followers, you know, if I had ever brought them joy in any way, if they'd ever liked a picture or anything like that, if they had a dollar in their Venmo account to just send it my way. And so I was able to raise $10,000 that day. And then, you know, went through the stress of that and figuring out how to allocate money, how to move the funds through my own accounts, and while also still running a business that I had no intentions of developing. So it's been a lot of managing emotions in a very, very wild time. In this time, I've grown to understand how expansive my role as an artist is. I say that I make art about small accumulative actions. I work in abstract line work, and everything in our life is a result of a series of small accumulative actions. And that's anything. That's when you're examining gentrification, you can't look at it in this large scope format. You need to understand that it's happening on so many micro levels. And so looking at my work as a fundraiser, I asked for $1, I got $10,000. Even mask making, where I started with 30 and now I've made hundreds. You know, looking at the Black Revolution of 2020, thinking about where we spend our money, thinking about the things that we say, all of the little things we do all day long, because those are the actions that really affect the world.
Atiyah Jones is an artist and a mask maker in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Tell us about your economy, would you? No matter what you do, no matter where you are, help us tell your stories. Marketplace.org is where you do that. Coming up.
They've taken the temperature of the moment and shape-shifted in response.
And the temperature of this moment feels pretty high. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 459 points today, 1.7%, 26,287. The NASDAQ picked up 226 points, that's about 2.2%, 10,433. The S&P 500 up 49 points, percent and a half, 31.79. Now, Contrast that upbeat take on things with this, courtesy of the COVID economy numbers on our website, marketplace.org. The job hiring rate in the United States right now, let me say that again, the job hiring rate in the U.S. right now, and this is according to LinkedIn, is down almost 40% compared to last year. So what kind of company stock is doing well? Well, here's one. Beauty supply retailer Sally Beauty Holdings has been doing pretty well, even with salons closed. Keeps on doing well. It looks like shares in Sally's gained 2.9% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story here of interest to those who've bumped up the number of hours they have spent on Netflix or HBO Max, or especially this past weekend, Disney Plus. The Writers Guild of America has reached a tentative deal with the big Hollywood studios after a month and a half of Zoom negotiations. One of the big sticking points? Streaming, because it has been both a blessing and a curse for Hollywood writers. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has that one.
We're living in what's being called the golden age of television. Thanks to an array of streaming platforms, there are more TV shows than ever and more opportunities for talented and diverse new writers. It's also easy to stream old favorites, Mad Men, Sex and the City, The Sopranos. But for a lot of writers, there's the ongoing issue of residuals, money they get every time a show is rerun. Consider NBC's The Office.
All right, everybody. There has been a lot of name calling against our office today. Corporate maligning, slurring, much of it coming from one of you who claims that prison is better than here.
Danny Kravitz, a screenwriter who teaches at Columbia College Chicago, says when a show like that gets rerun on your local TV station,
every time you're watching that, some distributor had to pay money for you to watch that again, and that money is getting broken down and, you know, distributed to the people who created it.
But when a show goes on a streaming platform like Netflix, it's a
one-time deal. One-time deal. And again, they try to account for some of what that back end would be, but you're not going to have those huge hits.
And they would be huge because up until last year, The Office was the most watched show on Netflix, which brings up another issue with streaming. Unlike traditional TV, platforms like Netflix don't release ratings, and it makes it harder for writers to negotiate new contracts based on how popular their product is. Tim Hanlon is a media analyst with the Vertier Group.
Television measurement was relatively simple back in the day when there were less choices. And the technology needs to catch up with how increasingly complicated the delivery and the viewership of television has become.
The Writers Guild of America has now reached a tentative new agreement with content producers. Its terms haven't been made public, but reportedly include an increase in streaming residuals. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
McDonald's, among many other big companies and brand names, has said it supports Black Lives Matter. Unlike some of those companies, though, McDonald's has a long history with black communities, both consumers in them and business people who do business there. Dates back to the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. Marcia Chatelain is a professor of history at Georgetown University. She is also the author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. It is, to be sure, a complicated story. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Why McDonald's? What made you want to tell this story through that company?
I think McDonald's is the ultimate prism in which to understand the history of business in America, as well as race, the ways that it appears and shapes processes in the background, and what happens when businesses engage with African American communities in the foreground.
It's so interesting because background is not a place you typically think of McDonald's as being, but there is great subtlety, actually, in McDonald's interaction with, as you put it in this book, black capitalism, right?
Absolutely. So prior to 1968, McDonald's was very much a suburban brand. And a lot of the building of early McDonald's was predicated on the policies that shut out African Americans from opportunity, whether it is the segregated suburb or the highway system that led to the removal of a lot of African American neighborhoods. Race has always been at the core of McDonald's and its ability to expand. After 1968, basically the idea was, if you bring fast food to African American communities, does it expand economic opportunities? And my book traces the history of that idea and the ways that it succeeded and the ways that it failed.
Well, I don't want anybody not to buy the book because of the answer you're about to give, because it's an important book to read. But did it work is the interview question.
Well, I'm a professor, so I will always say it's complicated. In terms of capitalizing on the spirit of a post-1968 move to build black businesses in African-American communities, it worked. McDonald's was able to franchise in locations that it had ignored. Many African-American franchisees became wealthy and were able to contribute to their communities. But the larger costs are something we're still grappling with, whether it's the low wages or the health disparities or the access to fresh food in communities of color. We see that it really has been an incredibly mixed and challenging legacy.
I want to pick up on that date that you've mentioned a couple of times, because a cynic might point to 1968 and say, a key year in the civil rights movement, America was changing, and here comes this previously majority white servicing company that says, hey, look, there's business opportunity in black America.
So after the uprisings in 1968, particularly the ones linked to Martin Luther King's assassination in April, the idea of black capitalism and developing black business really took hold, because you have folks like Nixon, who was not a friend of civil rights, who could get behind the idea because it doesn't disrupt neighborhood composition. It doesn't desegregate schools or housing. And then I think for a lot of liberals who were exhausted by not seeing civil rights realized in their lives, the pivot to business felt practical. And it also felt like this was actually an opportunity to give black Americans something in their own communities. And so these two forces came together, and the fast food industry understood that, and they really capitalized on it.
This book starts with an anecdote in Ferguson, Missouri, in the summer of 2014, where the local McDonald's on Florissant Street, right, became kind of a headquarters for the various disparate actors in that moment, which I just found illustrating. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I think McDonald's and chaos and unrest are kind of deeply tied in ways that we can see, but we need sometimes a larger lens to understand. So the McDonald's on Florissant Avenue in Ferguson remains open during most of the unrest. And you see protesters and police officers and news folks all in the same space. And I think about it in terms of the recent George Floyd protests. I think about it in terms of the Rodney King uprisings, that there are these moments where worlds are colliding at this place that everyone has been to more or less, but it means such different things in different communities because of race.
Is Black Lives Matter a moment for McDonald's? What are they doing?
Well, I think that McDonald's is doing something that they've done for a really long time. They've taken the temperature of the moment and shape-shifted in response. So they are seizing upon a corporate shift towards supporting Black Lives Matter. But one of the things that I think a lot of these companies don't understand is that when you declare that Black Lives Matter, you shift the terrain of the debate. Now people are going to say, well, prove it. Don't just show it in terms of donations to organizations. How are you treating black workers? How are you making sure that what you're doing can actually enrich black communities instead of just exploit them?
Marcia Chatelain is a professor of history at Georgetown University. Her most recent book, it's out now, is called Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. Professor Chatelain, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've got an excerpt from that book about the McDonald's, actually, down in Ferguson, Missouri, and the story of the very first black owner of a McDonald's franchise. You can read it all at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which you are reminded that immigration policy is labor policy, and also that Harvard University announced today its fall semester is going to be online only. So, this item. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement announced a new rule today, the relevant part of which reads verbatim as follows. Non-immigrant F1 and M1 students, those are student visa categories, non-immigrant F1 and M1 students attending schools operating entirely online may not take a full online course load and remain in the United States. Active students, the ruling goes on, currently in the United States enrolled in such programs must depart the country or take other measures, such as transferring to a school with in-person instruction to remain in lawful status. So, you work your whole life, you get into Harvard, you enroll, undergraduate or graduate, and now, because of this pandemic, your school's decision, and government policy, you have to leave the country. Once again, immigration policy is long-term labor and workforce policy. All right, we're out of here, but not without your moment of economic context to start the week. You might have already heard this, but it bears a mention here anyway on a program about business and the economy. Uber is going to spend $2.5 billion to buy the food delivery company Postmates. That puts Uber at number 2 in the food delivery space. And it comes, and bear with me here because I'm making a turn, it comes on the day that Amazon's share price topped $3,000 apiece because we are all ordering so much stuff to our homes. Eventually, they're going to be like 5 companies in this entire economy. All right, now we're really leaving. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.